Okay, so welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibarakian, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Tom Limicelli, internationally recognized author, speaker, and system administrator. Tom, thank you for coming in today and sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be invited.
Now, I want to congratulate you on your successes. You just had so many of them. You have such an amazing journey, and you've done so much. Can you describe some of that journey and some of the continuing insight that you've gained from an early age to, let's say, 18, and some of the milestones?
Well, you're making me blush. Thank you. So I had I'll start with my childhood. I had a kind of typical suburban childhood. My father was a chemist. My mother was an office worker. I went to public school, I always had a big interest in how things worked and how to build things. My parents, in the 70s, before computers were a big deal, so my parents always thought I'd be an architect or some kind of construction worker. I remember being very little, and anytime there was construction on the street, I would just go out there like every day and watch them during the summer or whatever. I wasn't the most academically strong person. I think I was just always distracted and bored, which is something they say of really brilliant people, but I think it happened to me too. Let's see, college, I went to a very small university called Drew University in Madison, New Jersey, and that really helped me because it's a small school and I got to be a big fish in a small pond. It was small enough that students were able to play an integral role in running the computer center. I went from being help desk support to one of the student managers of the help desk. And this is also when campus networking was brand new. So we were bringing the first campus network to the university, and it wasn't even Ethernet. It was earlier technologies. But I was one of the students that was heavily involved in the project. So I had this rare opportunity to see firsthand how people go through a large multi-million-dollar bidding process and dealing with vendors and then dealing with the rollout itself. Students wrote a lot of the software that made the network work, and it was really a unique opportunity.
So it sounds like the life at the university had a major sort of impact on your life. Are there additional milestones that you can share from that time and how those milestones and lessons continue to shape your vision into the future?
Sure. Well, one way is building a campus network. I mean, obviously the vendors did the heavy lifting and everything, but the students were involved in a lot of the planning and the software and the education. So I learned how to teach, at the time these were rudimentary skills, like what is email and stuff to, hundreds of students. And also another formative thing in university is I was also involved in a lot of political activism. And I learned that, you can talk and talk and talk and you can have great ideas, but if you don't have a way of sharing those ideas, then you're just staying in your own bubble. And so I learned to be an activist and an advocate, and I applied those things also not just in politics, but in technology. So, for example, the first academic paper I ever wrote was on treating, it was kind of analyzing help desk operations, not from a technical point of view, but from a advocacy/advocate point of view, and not being the person that's processing a request, but being the person that is the advocate for the user and helping them get through their roadblock or new request or whatever. So that was one of the formative things that happened in my university is my activism experience and later applying that to technology.
Now, Tom, you've had some really interesting roles, such as with Bell Labs, Google, and others. Can you share some of the lessons from those roles?
Sure. I was at Bell Labs for 7 years, and I was on a system administration team that wasn't part of the central IT organization. We were in the research part of Bell Labs. So in Bell Labs, you had labs like the physics lab and the computer science lab and communication lab and stuff. And we were on a team that was that served four of those labs, not physics, but math, computer science, communication, and a couple others. And so it was really quite a gift to just be surrounded with so many smart people. A lot of the famous Unix people, names like Ken Thompson, Dennis Ritchie, and stuff were some of my users. And someone once told me that you're as smart as the average of the five people that you hang out with the most. And I feel like I learned so much. I never went to graduate school, but being at Bell Labs for 7 years and being around so many PhDs, I felt like a lot of that rubbed off on me, just as far as the ethic and aesthetics of graduate school. What I learned, some of the big lessons I learned at the labs was, first of all, how to learn and the importance of always be learning. I also learned that one of the most important questions you can ask is, why are we doing this? In technology, people are always saying, oh, look, here's some new technology. Isn't this shiny? Isn't this neat? And often we don't pause and say, well, wait, what problem are you trying to solve? Why are we doing this? And try that with a technical person sometime. Ask, what problem are you trying to solve? And it will stop them in their tracks, and they will often say, I don't know, and it will take them a while to answer that. But once they do, then they're much more clear and focused about what they're trying to achieve. The other thing I learned at Bell Labs is stop doing things that don't work. Sounds like an obvious thing, but it's amazing how much we do, how much is done in the world because it's what we've always done. And people don't take the time to stop and think and realize that we're doing something that doesn't work. We should stop doing that. I think the extreme movement, which was one of the predecessors to the Agile movement, their breakthrough was when they realized certain things in the industry that don't work, and we've been lying to ourselves, claiming that they do work, and that we need something else. For example, this has been adopted by the Agile methodology. One of the lies that we've always been telling ourselves is that we can estimate how long a large project will take. That's a lie. We need to face that. And so a better thing is 2-week sprints. We can predict how much we can get done in about a week or two. And so this is a whole methodology based around that. And that's quite revolutionary. And I'm sure a lot of people listening to this interview are thinking, but I'm working on a $1 billion project. How, obviously we can predict when it's going to get done. Otherwise we couldn't get the bid. But I would challenge them and say, look at how many projects. I think the projects that get done on time are the exception rather than the rule. After Bell Labs, I was at a couple of small companies, I guess what I learned there is that I'd rather be at a big company. then I was at Google for 7 years, and that was really amazing because I lucked out. I was there from 2000. I started in 2006, and I was there at their hyper-growth period, and I was able to witness so much was going on around me, so much that I can't take credit for any of this, but I was able to be there when they were building their first data center. I got to see that when they were building their own homebrew network equipment and watch the 4 or 5 generations and just see a company that could make progress faster than anything else. When I was at Bell Labs was owned by AT&T and then Lucent, and I always felt that these were organizations that not just move slowly, but they would make the way that moving slowly affected the employees was employees got to the point where I felt that they no longer believed when the company would say, this time next year we will ship this product or we will achieve this great thing. I think it got to the point where the employees were just not believing it, and that was quite disheartening. And when I got to Google, they would say, 3 months from now we're going to do this, and I'd say that's going to take years. And then 3 months later, they'd have achieved it, and I was amazed. And I remember being on my 3 months in and seeing that exact thing happen, and thinking, wow, this is going to be a lot different than any other company I've ever worked at. And it truly was. And so I learned a lot of just the way to manage projects in ways that are much more aggressive. And one of the things that Google did was assume success. It set a much higher bar for your coworkers. And also, I've been at organizations where a success was not assumed. So there was less, it became okay to not succeed, but also if you're not assuming you're going to succeed, then you're going to plan for 5 different outcomes. You're going to plan the success outcome. You're going to have a backup plan in case things don't succeed. You're going to do 5 times as much work as opposed to, if you're confident that things are going to succeed and they do succeed, then you don't have to buy, 3 forms of insurance. But the other things, the other lessons I learned at Google was just that the future is 24/7. I kind of knew that intuitively because the web is 24/7, but Google is really, really 24/7. I remember shortly after starting there, I was at a party and I was talking to a journalist, and I said that I worked at Google, and she said, "Oh, Google is how journalism works nowadays. I Google for everything that I'm writing." And she asked what I did, and I said, "Well, I'm the site reliability team, which means I make sure that the website always stays up." And I remember her arm kind of she kind of clutched her chest and slammed her hand against her chest and said, "If Google went down, I don't know what I would do." And that made such an impression on me, this is really important. This isn't some billing application like I previously worked on, or a research organization where if the network was down, we could spend time analyzing the theoretical aspects of our project. This is real. And when things are really 24/7, you build things differently. My bank is 24/7, except they go down once a year for a whole Saturday to do maintenance. And you never see Google or Facebook or any of these other companies with a little banner that says, Google will be down Saturday afternoon for upgrades. So that requires designing that kind of thing from the very start. And in fact, much of distributed computing lends itself to the ability to design things from scratch so that things are going to be up. And even when Google does take things down, Google's constantly taking back-end services down, but you don't see it at the customer level because things were designed from the start to assume that everything has to be up all the time. The other thing I learned about distributed computing at Google is about the economics, about how the economics of distributed computing just seem to be so much better and are so much better. This is why a company like Dropbox can provide storage for a small company at a cheaper rate than your local IT guy can design and build a file server bought from a Dell HP kind of vendor. It's quite amazing. And it was such a gift to be there when a lot of the early operational aspects around how to keep such systems running was being developed and iterated on and improved. For the last 2.5 years, I've been at StackOverflow.com, which I'm sure most listeners are familiar with. It was kind of becoming the Wikipedia for developers. It's a question and answer website. And even though it's very large in its impact, it's actually a relatively small shop. We just have 2 data centers. We actually have, people think this is a Q&A website, but we actually have the Q&A website and also the Stack Overflow Careers, which is our job hunting system. And what I've learned there is, well, first of all, it's different technologies that I've worked with before. So I'm more of a Unix background person, and Stack Overflow is a mixture of Unix and Windows. So applying a lot of this stuff that I've learned to a Windows environment has been a unique challenge. And also just being at such a smaller scale, I remember when I was at Google and I'd give a talk and people would say, oh yeah, but that doesn't work at small shops. And I'd say, oh, you can make it work. Just scale it down a bit. And now I'm actually scaling down a bit. I'm like, oh, okay, that's what these people were talking about. So, I'm making a lot of these, distributed computing, things work at a smaller scale means, things aren't going to be as automated or unified, or we're not going to have the staffing to build everything from scratch. So we're relying on open source projects and vendors to supply parts, which is its own unique challenge because that means we're gluing together stuff that maybe wasn't meant to be glued together. Which reminds me of one other thing that I learned at Google was the value of vertical integration. So people think that Google is kind of crazy for having homebrewed their whole stack. But the simplicity of having one unified way for everything to talk to each other, to be configured, to be managed, it saves so much time in every other way versus where I am now, where we're constantly having to glue together things that were intended to be compatible together. I guess that's one of the benefits of being at the size and scale that Google is.
Now, such a great opportunity that you've had over the years. And I've actually had a chance to interview some people like Eve Anderson, Maggie Johnson, Eric Schmidt, Jeff Dean and Robin Pimentel, who have either are at Google now or have left Google. Have you had a chance to interface with any of these people, or even Larry and Sergey?
Not directly, though I did once have lunch with Sergey, which is an interesting story because nowadays Larry and Sergey, when they travel around, they have it's not an escort. They have some kind of, entourage around them. But there was one day in the New York. I was in the New York office of Google, and which being 3,000 miles away from the headquarters certainly had certain benefits. And one day I was in the cafeteria and saw Sergey walking through the line just like all other employees, and he kind of gets the end of the kitchen and into the seating area, and he's looking around kind of lost and kind of lonely. And I waved and asked, I said, Sergey, are you looking for someone to have lunch with? And he joined me and the 6 or 7 other people I was sitting with. And, it was quite a pleasure to have a conversation with him because, he's very open and honest. And, he went around the table asking each of us what we did. And then, we kind of pelted him with all sorts of crazy questions that I'm sure he gets all the time. And we ended up talking a lot about energy policy. I'll never forget that. But as far as working on projects, no, I can't say I interface with those people directly.
You know, you've got this amazing reputation. And so what tips can you share And again, updated to reflect current and future problems and solutions from your notable books. And you've written a number of them. And perhaps you can talk about those just amazing books that you've written and then also some updated tips from them.
Sure. And, you know, I appreciate the compliment. I also want to say I never feel like, well, I feel like more of a journalist reporting on stuff than having invented things. So I appreciate any credit people give me for a lot of this stuff. But I think I'm much more humble. Let me go through the books in order that they came out and talk about some of my reflections on them. My first book was The Practice of System and Network Administration, which I co-wrote with Kristen Hogan, and later editions we added another co-author, Strata Chalup. And the point of that book was we wanted it to be a general system administration book, but we didn't want it to be technical, we wanted it to be strategic. So the chapter on how to do backups in every system administration book ever written said backups, you type this command and then you're done. And we didn't want to do that. We want to say to do backups, read one of the other books. But what's important about backups to us is the planning, that there's really three reasons why you do backups. And here they are. And here's for each of them what's important. And you know what's really important for all backups? It's restores. In fact, backups don't matter at all. All people care about is restores. If we could find a way of doing restores without doing backups, we'd be so happy. Because backups, they kind of suck. They're painful. They're expensive. They slow down the system while they're running. And so the book is all about that kind of, you know, what's important here kind of advice. And the themes that run throughout the book are really about people skills and automation and simplicity. So I think it's the first book on system administration that was not technology specific. It's gender agnostic. And I think that's what made it special. I'm actually in the process of updating. We're right now we're writing the third edition, and we're keeping that ethic and we're just expanding a lot of the chapters to have more of a specific DevOps-y kind of flair. Interestingly enough, I think a lot of the foundational philosophy of DevOps is expressed in our first book, but we didn't, you know, DevOps didn't exist. DevOps packaged a lot of what we've been saying. So in this big update, we're now saying it in the new DevOps terminology. Those learnings are really vertical integration, that the way to be more successful and more efficient in what you do is to leave your silo and talk to your upstream providers and your downstream consumers, and which is actually quite revolutionary. Most IT departments, they do their thing, and that's it. You know, I'm the person in charge of accounts. I create accounts, I delete accounts, I make changes to accounts. That's all I do all day. And they're in that silo, and when you when you break out of that silo and start talking to people around you, you learn, oh, you know, what would make this person's job easier is, you know, having an API, or we do have an API, but it doesn't have the functionality that is needed. Or really, we shouldn't think of accounts as accounts. We should think in terms of the whole HR ERP tracking system, and we're just a component of that, and how can we all work together? So the more global you look at things, the better job you can do. And the more we can automate things. So much of, actually, there's a quote from the book that I really like, which is about two people were disagreeing on what the configuration should be for the workstations that they're deploying to all employees. And, it's a long story, but the short version is, in the end, what they realized is after listing what their disagreements were, what their agreements and disagreements were, the agreements were the easy part. The disagreements were things that they were going to have to resolve. And they decided that rather than document their decisions, they were going to code their decisions and let the code that automates how machines are installed, that would be the documentation of what they do. And that leads to the whole infrastructure as code and other principles that are so important. The next book that I wrote was it was called Time Management for System Administrators. And the inspiration for that book is literally that my first book was 700 pages long, and I got a lot of positive feedback, but people would often say that they didn't have time to read the whole book. And it dawned on me one day that, you know, the biggest problem in IT is time management. No one ever feels like they have enough time. We're all overloaded. We're all working 80 hours a week and driving ourselves nuts. And I used to be a time management disaster until I learned a couple basic things and a couple coping mechanisms. And so I decided my next book would be Time Management for System Administrators. And it's basically all my coping mechanisms, all my strategies. It's also a very short book because I think people that need a book like this can't read a long book. So the take-homes from that book are essentially you need two things to be successful in IT from a personal management point of view. And one of those is a way to manage the interruptions that are coming in, because people are always getting interrupted, not just, instant messages and emails and people stopping by your office, but just everything, most work comes to IT, certain system administrators at least, their work comes to them in the form of an interruption. And so you need a way of managing those interruptions. And then the second thing that you need is a way of organizing your work. So now your work's come in either through interruption or through a better way. Now you need a way to organize your work. And a lot of people, especially younger people in IT, they're very first in, first out oriented, or the loudest person gets their attention. And you need a better way to organize your work. And my recommendation there is actually what now agile people would call a one-person, one-day sprint. So basically at the beginning of every day, you put some thought into what you plan on doing that day. And then you work that mini to-do list. So it's kind of like having a little to-do list for every that you write every morning. And you follow through with it. So so that's the basic take homes of that book. The next book is The Practice of Cloud System Administration, which I wrote with Christine Hogan and Strata Shallop. And that was an attempt to take all the lessons that I had learned from Google and all the lessons that we had learn from the DevOps movement and kind of try to capture that. And even though it has cloud in the title, it's not really just a cloud book. It's vendor agnostic and platform agnostic. So whether you're on premise or truly in the cloud, in someone else's cloud, this is a book really about service management. So to have a service that is really manageable, you have to start at the design stage. You have to make sure certain things are designed in. So we have an, so we try to teach system administrators about distributed computing and distributed design, not so much that it'll make them a PhD in distributed computing. They're not going to be that kind of expert, but we wanted to give people the vocabulary so that they can communicate with the developers and also be able to ask the right questions. So we have an entire chapter that's just on, what questions should you be asking your developers at the beginning of the design so that 6 months or a year later when the design is done, it's a manageable system. So many times we see big projects fail because after all this time and money spent on development, they go to launch, and a week before the launch, the system administrators ask, well, how are you going to back this up, or what do we do in a failover situation? And the developers say, oh, we never thought about those things. And now they either launch without those things, which is dangerous, or the launch gets delayed, which causes its own host of problems. So the first half of the book is about the design of large distributed systems. And even though you might not be designing yet, you need the vocabulary so you can talk to the designers. And then the second half is about operating a large complex system. And this is very much kind of, well, what we learned from working at Google and other large companies. So it's how to manage on call, how to do monitoring. Google is so good at monitoring. I would say Google is actually a monitoring company that designs applications that so that they have something to monitor. That's how good they're at monitoring. And we talked about the better economics of management at scale, managing large complex systems at scale, that kind of thing. And I really, my hope is that the cloud book is the book that can help companies that are struggling with running large web services or even non-web services and get their arms around what they're trying to do and what they're trying to manage so that they can not just have a more stable service, but have less stress in the lives of their IT employees.
Well, that's a lot of insight being shared with the audience and your readers of your book, and I can see why you've developed such a great reputation throughout the world because of these books that you've written. I know that you're also embedded in these conferences as well, and a major participant. Can you describe some of the takeaways from some of these conferences that you're involved with?
Sure, and I love conferences. I've been involved in conferences in and out of tech, I guess since college, and I not only enjoy the conferences for their content, but just the grandeur and the theatrics, and I enjoyed the planning. I've met some really amazing people through conference planning, and made a lot of friends. And if you're looking for a way to network and at the same time help the world, get involved in conference planning. In and out of tech, some of the early activist conferences that I learned, one of the organizers kept using this phrase. He said, conferences build community. Every time someone asks, why are we having this conference? It's because conference builds community, and you need, this movement needs community. And that's just as true in the technical community. So I've mostly been involved in Usenix-related conferences, and I attended my first Usenix conference in 1989 on a student grant, which I think was $80, which was so much money at the time for a student. So what have I learned through conferences? I've learned that it's not just who you know, or it's not just what you know, but who you know. One of my, I believe everyone in the world has some kind of superpower, and my superpower is my social network. Someone can ask me a technical question about some technology I've never heard of, and I feel like because I've attended enough conferences, I can find someone that does know about that technology, and I can reach out to that person and either be the connector or the relay. It's also how I learned to do public speaking. I didn't really learn public speaking until I started doing it at conferences, and I took a public speaking class in college. I don't want to sound ungrateful, but I think I learned so much more by being at an audience of 100 people. My first public talk was at a LISA conference. It was my first paper presentation. And the LISA conference is not an academic conference. It has academic origins. And one of the most important things that I've learned speaking there is to front-load the talk. I think a lot of people make the mistake of making presentations that I compare it to a mystery novel. It builds and builds and builds, and surprise, the butler did. That's the format of a mystery, but you know, a lot of conference presentations I see are building, 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 and surprise, here's the algorithm, or here's the take-home, here's the result. And what I find, what I learned is a much better format is you begin with the surprise. You say, you know, we achieved this with this algorithm, and then explain the details. And it's not just good presentation, it's also good theater, and it's also good time management, because if someone can attend the first 5 minutes of your talk and say, oh, I know this already, or I make that judgment that they don't need to attend the rest of the conference or rest of that talk, and they can move to one of the other sessions of the conference.
Again, just great evidence of your diversity of experiences that you have. Now, you know, your work at Stack Overflow, can you maybe describe some scenarios that you've encountered in the solutions and maybe some notable results from your work?
Sure. You know, what I learned at Stack Overflow is if something, so one of my biggest projects at Stack Overflow has been to improve our ability to fail over to our disaster recovery site. And also do, which is a similar skill as moving a data center, which is kind of like failing over permanently to another site. And doing those kind of failovers, either big data center failovers or just a little, you know, database master slave failover, these are risky things. And what I've learned is that if something's risky, you should do it a lot, which is quite radical, because most people say, well, if it's risky, we should avoid it. But you want to, you know, drunk driving is risky, so we should avoid that. And I totally agree with that statement. But in technology, a risky process is inherently risky, but a risky procedure is only risky because you don't do it often enough. If you do it more, then you get better at it. I mean, the technical or the scientific term is practice makes perfect, right? We've been taught this since we were little kids. Failing over our data center is very risky at Stack Overflow. So we forced ourselves to do it a lot. We started doing fire drills every other month for a while until we got a lot better at doing these failovers. And each time we did it, we filed tons of bugs. We learned lots of problems. So, for example, the first time we did it, it was estimated that it would just take about an hour. It ended up taking about 10 hours, and a lot of that time was waiting as we were figuring out ad hoc solutions to unexpected problems. And the next time we did it, it took about 5 hours, and then 2 hours, and I think the last time we did it, it was less than an hour. So we had all these learnings from forcing ourselves to do it. And these were learnings that we made on a Saturday when everyone was awake and available. And that's the best time to learn that there's a problem because you can fix it right then and there. If we were learning that there was a problem with our failover mechanism during a real failover, that would be very dangerous. The right people might be on vacation. You know, one of the things we learned is that there was only one person that knew how to do a certain procedure. So that person couldn't be on vacation if we had a real emergency. And that doesn't work very well. So that was an important learning, and now we've trained up multiple people on the team with that particular task. There were certain things were just very cumbersome, and they've been automated, or error-prone, and they've been better documented. So that's one of my favorite bits at Stack Overflow is seeing that progression from a very chaotic process to a very smooth process. The other thing that, or another thing that I learned at Stack Overflow is that often using a ticket system is the wrong dynamic. So a lot of IT teams, they're very ticket focused. So someone wants something, so they open a ticket, making the request. The IT person does the thing, and then close the ticket. And it's very transactional, like a transactional database, right? You make the request. The request is done over and over and over, and that creates a power dynamic that is kind of a master-slave relationship or a waterfall-ish relationship, right? The users, they don't have to understand everything that's involved. They just understand, I can plop this request and it gets done. And that leaves very little opportunity for optimization and automation. So what we've been experimenting with at Stack is using Kanban boards with Trello and different ways of organizing our work.
Tom, you are sort of in the middle of so much, and there's so much noise out there. You'd be a perfect one to sort of seek curated advice on. So what would be your top most useful resources that you use that you find the most practical?
Well, let's see. I think you kind of stumped me there. Let's see. But
well, I think all of your current and future books would be a great resource. Just put a plug in.
Sure. Actually, can I tell you one of the things that I want to say about the book is, or the books that I've written are just the, I don't want to brag, but I do want to say that the most gratifying results of the book have come from the fans. There are some companies that the practice of system and network administration, there's some companies that all new IT employees get a copy of, and some very large companies, which was quite honoring, flattering. But also, some of the messages I got email from a woman in Japan who said that she thought that she was the only person in IT that was struggling, and reading this book and reading the various anecdotes in it, she realized that she wasn't the only one, and she said that she cried, and that she was just so happy to know that that IT can be stressful but can be so much better. I got a message from after writing the time management book, I got a couple fan messages, and this is kind of a self-help book, so I've gotten very personal messages, and one actually came from the wife of a system administrator who said, "Thank you for giving me my husband back." And that just, tore me up inside. It was like, wow, that I had no idea that this book would help people on such a personal level. And I'm really, really glad that I've been able to have that influence on a personal level, not just helping people, not just helping companies, make more widgets each week.
Now, I'm going to do a bit of a shift in this interview. I know you do work for nonprofits such as the Association for Computing Machinery, just as a really premier, prestigious scientific innovation professional association, really the world's largest. Can you talk about some of that work?
Sure. I love working with ACM. I've been an ACM member since 1988. I was a sophomore, I guess, or a freshman in college, and they had a great student discount, and I've been to computing competitions and stuff, and then later, after graduation, got involved with some committees. And I find that the ACM publications always are very enlightening, and sometimes I'll pick a publication that is totally outside of my interest just to read a couple random articles and just make myself aware of what's happening in that field. And what I've gotten out of volunteering with them has been more networking contact, and also a lot of useful stories that I've been able to use in my writing. A lot of the anecdotes that are in my book, the anonymized ones are always from different people that I've met at different events.
Tom, could you talk more about some of the continuing value of Q and applicative in particular, and maybe some of the articles that you think will be appearing in future Q editions, if you can talk about those things, and then also what you anticipate for the 2016 applicative conference and some of the maybe the topic areas that may appear there, or maybe things that you may wish to talk about, and maybe in addition, maybe some useful tips that have come from applicative in Q.
Sure. I'm more involved in Q than applicative. And what I really like about Q is that it's trying to bridge the academic world to the practical practitioner world. One of the criticisms of the ACM is that it's too academic and too ivory tower. And so my volunteerism lately with the ACM has all been related to bridging the gap to what I call the real world. And that's important for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think there are so many jewels inside the ACM, and if they're not shared around the world, then what good is it? I'm the kind of person that would rather make a broad impact than a narrow, deep impact. So, you know, I'd rather make a small improvement that affects everyone in the world and make a big improvement that nobody ever sees, or very few people ever see. Not see, but affects them positively in the world. So it's also important in the other direction, in that I think academics and researchers need more exposure to what's happening in the real world. I think that helps their research better. There's no better proof of a theory than seeing in the field actually work. And so if you're studying distributed systems or anything, if you need the channel to talk to people that are actually doing that kind of work, I think ACMQ is a good way of getting your message out to them. And so let's see. I think some of the good articles that we've seen lately have been on some of the ways that, for example, performance engineering or optimization in CPUs and memory systems makes the way you write code very differently. And let's see, some of the other good articles have been, so things are very much changing in storage and memory and networking. A lot of what I learned in school about networking, parallel processing, storage, all those rules of thumbs and theory kind of breaks down in today's world where, you know, chips have multiple cores and the new wave of hard drives where they literally can't rewrite a single sector. They have to rewrite multiple tracks at a time. That's changing the way that operating systems need to be designed and databases and that kind of thing.
Tom, you're so widely read, and you're involved in an array of different kinds of activities. So you're going to have your finger on the pulse of what's happening in the world. Do you have a sense of some of the megatrends that are out there that you think will shape our lives and our world, our destiny, and our work?
I think the biggest trend happening right now is DevOps, which I realize DevOps it means a lot of different things to different people, but let me give you this definition. It's rapid release. It's the ability to go from developers writing code to getting in production very quickly. And instead of one big release once a year, doing weekly, monthly, or daily releases, so that, first of all, new features get to users faster, but also there's more opportunities to learn. So every time you launch, you learn. You learn, did users like this? You learn, how can we launch better? How can we optimize things better? And DevOps is all about learning and putting those learnings into action right away. So, and also a big part of DevOps is vertical integration. So breaking out of your silos and having the end-to-end process considered. Some of the optimizations, and I admit myself, some of the optimizations I've done on systems over the years only helped my team. And when you look at it at a global level, it may have been a global de-optimization. And that's so common in policy and technology work. And when you're working on a full end-to-end DevOps environment, you measure your scientific and you know that your improvements help the whole end-to-end process, not just yourself. A big part of that is, related to that megatrend is the trend towards vertical integration. I think that those of us who said that outsourcing is a mistake and have been saying that for 20 years are now being vindicated by so many success stories where companies have insourced because they needed faster response time. So if you're a retailer and you don't think of yourself as a software company, so you outsource your website and logistics and other things, you will soon, if you haven't noticed this already, you will soon see that your competition can beat you by just being able to manage the sales process better or the logistics process or be more efficient in getting, if you're having a discount on a product, not having to plan that 3 months in advance because that's how long it takes to get a change put on the website and coordinate it with the advertisements that you put in old media and television and other things. When you're vertically integrated, you can be more dynamic and you decide on a Monday that we're going to have a special deal on grapes, and by Wednesday, the TV ads have changed, the website ads have changed, the prices in all the stores have the price tags have been relabeled. That's all software nowadays. And to be able to manage that stuff dynamically and faster than your competition, you have to be vertically integrated. And so that's definitely, megatrend number two. And a lot of that's enabled by DevOps non-technologies, but philosophy and methodologies. And I think the third megatrend is that having management recognize that that every company is now a software company is becoming, it's not just a megatrend, it's becoming key to your ability to hire the best people. No one wants to work at a company that is working in the old methodology. And if you want to be successful, you have to hire the best people. People are not fungible resources. People are not just easy to replace Lego bricks that anyone will do. The competition is coming. The way to beat the competition is to have the best people. And to hire the best people, you need to have a work environment that is attractive. And that doesn't just mean having a nice cafeteria. It means having managers that having an entire management chain that is technical and understands software management as well as their own industry.
I'm going to sort of, again, switch directions a little bit and maybe ask you some questions in terms of innovation and startups and just get your viewpoints on that. Agility is key today with startups and launching new products and services within a larger enterprise. And it's pervasive, right? Even in larger, as I mentioned, enterprises, this sort of startup mentality. Do you have any sort of recommendations in doing innovations within an enterprise, or some of the steps that will lead to a success for a startup?
Let's break that down into things. So being successful in a startup is often different than innovating within a big company. I think that successful startups have to be willing to try new things, be willing to pivot a lot, but have that balance of not too much. And I think a lot of what makes startups successful is being first to market, and that means being incredibly agile. I think the difference in innovating in a big company is you need to be able to have an environment where you won't get punished for failures. So in the most big companies, everyone has become so afraid to try anything new because if it's not a success, there will be punishment. And I think most big companies don't know how to manage in a way that both doesn't punish failure, but also encourages success. I know that sounds like I'm saying the same thing, but they're very different things. So how do you encourage experimentation and a willingness to try new things? I've been at plenty of companies, or just as a customer of other companies, and I say, well, you know, this feature doesn't work. This website, you know, doesn't, you know, this could be so much better. And they say, well, you know, it's been that way for years. And it's very disheartening to me because I'm like, well, yes, but it's software. So it's not a hammer. It's not something that once it's manufactured, it really can't be changed. It's software. So why don't you have that ability to change the software? And I think that often comes from management who has either decided once something works, it's done, which is not how software is. Software is never done until it's not used anymore. That's when it's done. And hasn't created the infrastructure to permit changes from happening and also permits A/B changes so that tests and experimentation can thrive in your environment.
Tom, you worked in a variety of environments, and you would clearly understand what are, you know, sort of the attributes or the characteristics in individuals and teams that produces winning products and services. Can you give your opinions on some of this?
I can't give my opinion on, like, from the CEO level, but definitely from the operations side, I think that what makes an operations team successful is they can't have an oral tradition, they have to have a written tradition. So you need to write things down because not everyone on the team can know everything. And many IT teams, they rely on a few experts instead of empowering everyone on the team to be able to collaborate. The second thing I'd say is work in small iterations. Don't try to launch something big 3 months from now. Do a minimum viable product this week, and then weekly launches that have more and more features every week. And now, 3 months from now, you'll have a success because you'll have developed those operational skills along the way that after the launch, you're not struggling to figure out what to do operationally. And the third thing is infrastructure as code and code as policy. So running code is better than a document. So rather than saying we shouldn't do XYZ, you should have code that enforces it. Or instead of saying, you know, here's the 10 steps to doing this, you should have code that incorporates those 10 steps. And if someone disagrees and says the policy should be different or the process should be different, then that that difference should come in the form of a patch, you know, a code pull request, as I say in Git terminology, to say, you know, no, I think it should be this way instead. Because especially if your policy and process is incorporated in code, then it can be revision controlled. It can be, you can add unit tests. You can do rollbacks. And that's really revolutionary for an operational team.
Tom, you've been around the block. You've done a lot. You've been under high-pressure situations. You've seen the profession evolve. Do you think that computing itself should be a recognized profession on sort of on par with accounting or law with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics?
Sure. That's a very touchy subject because I'll admit I'm not sure where I stand because I see that there are USENIX and ACM, they've published code of ethics kind of documents. And I think those things are very important, and a profession needs that kind of thing. When you go so far as say, should there be licensing, I'm both in favor and against that. So, but I do think that one problem that I've seen is a lot of certifications that are out there are very vendor focused, and I would much rather see some vendor agnostic certifications. I really wish that it could be like the construction industry really got it right. You know, you have the let's look at just electricians. You have in the middle, you have people that can design the electrical system of a house, and above that, you have the PhDs that are inventing new ways of new devices and stuff that could be used in houses. And below that, you have your electricians that are actually doing the installation, and the people doing the installation, they don't need to know much beyond Ohm's law, right? I mean, I had an uncle who was in construction, and he didn't have, I think he went through to seventh grade, and he would say, for every six of these, you need one of these. And I'd say, why do you need that? And he'd say, well, because that's how it works. If you ask that same question to someone with a PhD, they'd explain the math behind why it works. And I wish computing could be more like that. I wish computing could be more like, for every six of these, you need one of these. It's much more complex. I don't think we could ever get there, but it'd be great if we could stratify the industry as being, you have your technicians, your architects, and your researchers, and that, maybe each of those has a different set of professional rules of thumb, code of ethics. Well, everyone probably would have the same code of ethics, but that kind of thing. As far as personal responsibility, I think there's a tension in our industry between people wanting to do the right thing versus having to follow corporate policy and regulations, and I think IT people are often pulled in conflicting directions around that, and that makes me sad. And I think if we had more of an emphasis on the professional development of our industry, we would be able to resolve a lot of those things.
Tom, we're down to our last question, and I'm going to give you maybe a couple of choices here. Maybe you can share one or more stories from all of your travels and speaking your work, or just sort of free form. Maybe there's a question I should have asked and you wish I asked it, and then what would be your answer? You choose.
I think I'm going to choose a story. I was working at a place. We had an incredibly complicated process, and it basically, it was more complicated than this, but I'll summarize it by saying it was a process involved in every time we opened a new office. Rolling out certain IT equipment. And there was, it was a huge effort, but we were opening up office after office after office. And my team was involved in just one aspect of that process. And we were often the team that was late, or didn't get things done as expected, or would run into these strange problems. And we took a step back And we said, well, why are we having problems? Do we actually know what the process is? And the team spent 6 months just documenting what is the actual process. And what we discovered is the process had, our part of the process had 24 steps that involved 15 teams. And that's huge. That's crazy. But we were able to draw those handoffs and connections and relationships into a big graph. And we started showing the graph to the 15 teams. We met one-on-one with each team, one at a time. We said, we think this is the process. Do you agree? Are the dependency errors all correct? And we got three reactions from the teams we met. One reaction was often, oh, we had no idea we were part of this process. We just knew that every time, about once a month, you would ask us for this thing and we would struggle to give it to you. So now we know that we're actually part of this larger process. The other reaction we got was, oh, the dependencies are wrong. You shouldn't ask for this until these three dependencies are resolved. And that's why things get so confused every time you put in this request. And you say, okay, we can fix that. And the third kind of request or response that we got was that we were, when we did interact with this other team for this handoff, the terminology was wrong, or the way we were asking for it was wrong, or whatever. And so we began this phase of correcting. We went from total chaos to a documented process to an optimized process. And then we put the process in code so that every time we were opening a new office, as each handoff was happening, there was a dashboard. Things were changing color from red to green as they were completing. We actually had each handoff added a deadline. And so now we could track, are we on time? We could start predicting how long things would take. We were optimizing things. And so I'm very, very proud of the team, because we went from everything based on lore to data to code as documentation and policy. And it made the whole process work so much better. And I'm just really proud of the whole team for being able to put that together. And it's a big effort, and it kind of typifies a lot of the projects that I've been on. And I know this isn't a technical system administration technology, solution. We didn't buy a product. We didn't, adopt some new algorithm. This is all meat and potatoes, bread and butter kind of, taking a process and making it work better through, just tenacious, documentation and improvement.
Well, Tom, I really appreciate you coming in today and just sharing so much of your insights and your wisdom. You are this notable figure, highly respected worldwide for all the work that you do. And we're indeed fortunate that you came in to do this interview and share so many of your experiences with our audience. So thank you so much.
Well, I'm flattered and honored, and I appreciate the invite, and I had a lot of fun. So thank you so much.
Again, the pleasure's for our audience. I know that they'll just gain so much from this. And I just want to close in saying I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Tom Limoncelli, internationally recognized author, speaker, and system administrator. Okay, that's it. Thank you. We could do a whole series with you. You just have a fountain of knowledge in so many different areas. So.
Thank you. I'm blushing. I really am. I don't feel like I'm worthy of being on this list. I looked at the list of all the people you've interviewed. I'm like, I'm nowhere near anything like these people. So this is quite a. I'm totally excited and thankful, and I can't express my gratitude enough. So, thank you.
Well, thank you, Tom. And you know what? As you know, I chair or vice chair different forums, such as the World CIO Forum. I'm going to ask you to speak as a possibility in the future, and also for economic forums. And by the way, some of them pay quite well. But the last one, I got $3,000 a minute. So,
okay. Yeah, I'd be interested.
Okay, thank you so much, and take
great,
care.
Great, thanks, and I appreciate you extending the extra time.
Okay, take care, and have a great holiday.
Cheers.
Okay, bye.
You too. Bye-bye.